The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's look at the Reader's Digest, World of Medicine. Substituting chicken for beef does not lower cholesterol. If you're trying to reduce your cholesterol, cutting back on red meat is a good idea. But don't replace it with white meat, says a new study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Research compared LDL, or bad cholesterol, levels among three groups of people over a three-month period. One ate mostly lean beef, one mostly lean chicken or turkey, and one mostly plant proteins. Only the plant-based diet reduced LDL. Women have younger brains than men. Just like the body's metabolism, the brain's metabolism tends to slow with age. In a study of more than 200 adults aged 20 to 82 with no brain damage or disease, researchers used positron emission tomography, PET, scans of the brain to measure each individual's metabolic brain age. They found that at any given time, women's brains are an average of 3.8 younger than their biological age, while men's brains are an average of 2.4 years older. God, I'm ancient. This could mean that the reason women don't experience as much cognitive decline in later years is because their brains are effectively younger, says one of the study's authors. We are currently working on a study to confirm that. Evening exercise may not hurt sleep. A workout late in the day interferes with your shut-eye, or does it? That's a common notion, but that's not the conclusion of Swiss review of the highest quality studies on the topic. The analysis found that although vigorous training activity that leaves you breathless, so to speak, within an hour of bedtime might be bad for your sleep, exercising slightly earlier or more moderately has a neutral to beneficial effect. That's good news for people who can't fit a workout into other parts of their day. Common cold virus exposes cancer cells. Cancer cells are dangerous in part because the immune system cannot detect them, so the body's natural defenses don't kick in. But there are viruses that can be used as treatment to destroy the invisibility shield. When they enter tumors, these viruses replicate like crazy until the tumor cells burst, releasing substances that allow the cancer to be seen and destroyed by immune cells. In one small British study, 15 patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer received a dose of common cold virus shortly before they underwent surgery to remove their tumors. In all cases, the virus successfully increased cancer cell death. In one, it appeared to have completely eradicated the cancer. Moreover, it did so without any significant side effects. Rheumatoid arthritis might lead to COPD. An analysis of the medical records of 50,000 people found that those who had rheumatoid arthritis, RA, had a 47% greater risk of being hospitalized for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, than those who did not. The prolonged inflammation of RA may predispose some people to COPD. Genetics also plays a part. Another study identified a DNA variation that was associated with COPD, RA, and other autoimmune diseases. RA sufferers need to look for early symptoms of COPD, such as wheezing and coughing, and avoid risk factors such as smoking. Developing a stress vaccine. In a recent experiment, a compound derived from the Mycobacterium vaccae, a bacterium naturally found in soil, turned to stress-related inflammation response in mice. Researchers hope that this compound to develop a stress vaccine could help prevent PTSD. Small calorie cuts benefit even slim people. In a two-year study of normal weight or slightly overweight adults aged 21 to 50, 143 participants were put on a diet designed to reduce the caloric intake by 25%. The rest ate their regular diet. For the first month, the dieters were fed at a clinical center, and for the first 6 months, they attended regular counseling sessions. With these aids, most were able to stick to their diets. But once those guardrails were removed, the dieters proved unable to maintain the same level of calorie restrictions. By the end of the 2 years, 26 dieters had dropped from altogether. Those remaining were able to cut their calorie intake by an average of only 12%, or about 300 calories per person per day. And yet the study yielded one surprising and encouraging result. It turns out that even the smaller reduction of calories produced significant health benefits. The dieters lost an average of 16.5 pounds after 2 years and reduced their insulin resistance cholesterol levels, blood pressure, and other risk factors for cardiovascular problems. They also had lower levels of C-reactive protein, a marker of inflammation that has been associated with heart disease, cancer, and cognitive decline. Graham Krause, MD, the study's lead author and a distinguished professor at cardiovascular genomics at Duke University, wasn't surprised that weight loss offered some benefit to the subject's heart health. But he says, we didn't expect the degree of improvement we saw. A painkiller reduces cardiac risk. A review of data from 6.3 million Danes, most aged 46 to 56, found that within 30 days of starting diclofenac, an anti-inflammatory often prescribed for arthritis pain, the risk of stroke, heart attack, and other major cardiovascular problems was 20% higher compared with those who took acetaminophen or ibuprofen, and 50% higher than those who took no painkillers at all. 13 things. Eye-opening facts about tears. Humans make three different versions of tears. Basal tears lubricate our eyes, reflex tears form in response to irritants such as smoke and dirt, and emotional tears flow when we're sad or overjoyed. All are made of salt water mixed with oils, antibodies, and enzymes, but they each also contain different molecules. Emotional tears, for example, carry protein-based hormones, including leucine enkephalin, a natural painkiller released when the body is under stress. Number two, onion tears are obviously in the reflex variety. But what's the irritant? It turns out onions secrete a compound to deter predators, a.k.a. hungry humans wielding a blade, called lacrimatory factor. To cut down on its release, refrigerate the onion before slicing. Then use a sharp knife to reduce the damage to the onion and the release of the compound. Number three, the Latin word for tear, lacrima, is the root of scientific terminology. Tears are generated at the lacrimal gland, which sits above the eye just under the eyebrow. And the word lacrimist is used to describe someone who tears up a lot, also known by the unscientific term of crybaby. Yes, we've known some of them. Number four. Actually, while babies cry a lot, they don't produce tears until they are 7 or 8 months old, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. You know who does shed a lot of tears? Study has found that women cry on average of 3.5 times a month, almost twice as much as men. On average, humans produce 15 to 30 gallons of tears a year. Wow. Number five, crying can be good for you. Some studies have shown that a good cry releases the oxytocin and endorphins, chemicals that make you feel better. Crying can also improve people's sense of well-being by generating social support, researchers have found. Number six, on the other hand, crying can sometimes make you feel worse than if you hadn't shed a tear. One study found that people who are prone to crying in general more often feel worse after crying during a movie than people who rarely cry. Number seven, according to Entertainment Weekly, the biggest Hollywood tearjerker of all time is Terms of Endearment, about how a family deals with a cancer diagnosis. Number two is Bambi. According to the Merriam-Webster, the term tearjerker debuted in 1912, which happens to be the same year the Titanic sank. The movie Titanic is 16th on EW's tearjerker list. Number eight, ever wonder why a cry causes your nose to run? Excess tears produced by the lacrimal glands pours into your tear ducts. From there, they drain into the nasal cavity where they mix with mucus to give you a runny nose. Number nine, for centuries, people thought tears were created by the human heart. The Old Testament says they're formed when part of the heart weakens and turns into water. In fact, many people cry in the Bible, though perhaps none explains the situation as poetically as David does in Psalm 56:8, when he says to God, You keep track of all my sorrows. You have collected all my tears in your bottle. You have recorded each one in your book. Number 10. In medieval times, crying was perfectly acceptable, even manly. In the Anglo-Saxon poem Beowulf, when Beowulf is killed by a dragon, his warriors were disconsolate and wailed aloud for their lord's decease. King Arthur was also known to turn on the waterworks. Speaking of war, tear gas was banned on the battlefield via the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1993, which spurred it by Iraq's use of chemical weapons in Iran in the 1980s. That said, American law enforcement agents are still legally use tear gas for crowd control. Number 12. Charles Darwin was fascinated by tears. For his book, The Expression of the Emotions of Man and Animals, the father of evolution collected observation of South African monkeys and indigenous Australians and compared them with his own kids. Darwin concluded, "We must look at weeping as an incremental result, as purposeless as the secretion of tears from a blow outside the eye. Yet this does not present any difficulty in our understanding of how the secretion of tears serves as a relief for suffering." Number 13. As we age, production of basal tears slows, which can lead to dry eyes. Women going through hormonal changes, such as pregnancy or menopause, are particularly susceptible. To help the situation, try lubricating eye drops, also called artificial tears, or use warm compresses on your eyes for a few minutes. The world is a zoo. We think of country names as coming from, well, where do they come from? Other than Iceland, that one's easy. It turns out that in their native languages, the names of many countries were inspired by animals. A few top dog examples: Albania, land of the eagle; Bhutan, land of the thunder dragon; Cameroon, river of prawns; Kosovo, field of blackbirds; Singapore, the lion city. Humor and uniform. I was awakened late one night by a phone call from a nearby Fort Meade in Maryland. Me, hello. Caller, is Sergeant Rodriguez there? Me, sorry you have a wrong number. Hang up. Ring. Caller, Sergeant Rodriguez? Still the wrong number. Do you have his right number? There's a roast post recall and he has to go to work. No, I don't. Hang up. And is Sergeant Rodriguez there? No, there's a post recall and he went to work. Okay, thanks. Got no more calls. In the 50s, I was a clerk typist at our bank headquarters in Verdun, France. We were a tough group. How tough? Our motto was, we never retreat. We just backspace. Long-lost sisters. This is Everyday Miracles. I come from a broken family that many would consider dysfunctional at very least. Marriages, divorces, etc. After we grew up, my siblings and I could go for years without speaking. And that is where this story begins. My sister Jean and I were born only 14 months apart, but by the time we were teenagers, we had lost touch. By age 19, I had moved away from our home in Wisconsin to live with my father, Horse Farm in Virginia, where I worked ultimately as a veterinary assistant and a bartender. Jean got married at 18, moved to Chicago, and became, well, I don't know what she became. We lived separate lives in separate states, and our connection somehow ended. Fast forward about 5 years. I was 24 and on a trip with my fiancé to New York City, a place I had never been. It was overwhelming. I was used to riding my horse to the corner store where everyone knew everyone and everything going on in the quiet little cowpoke town of Driver, Virginia. We had gone to New York to visit my fiancé's cousin and see the sights. We went to Little Italy, the Statue of Liberty, Chinatown, several Manhattan clubs. I had never seen so many taxicabs in one spot in all my life. During a day of sightseeing, we were crossing a very busy street loaded with people. Everyone was in a hurry, typical New York, hustling and bustling. I had laughed at something my fiancé said and suddenly heard my name yelled from somewhere behind me. Cheryl? I froze in my steps in the middle of the road, tears welling up spontaneously in my eyes. I knew without a doubt that it was my sister Jean. I yelled back before even turning around. Jean? It was her. Oh, my God, I screamed. And I began pushing people out of my way to get to her. The crowd started to part. Even by New York standards, we must have seemed crazy. And there we were, standing in the middle of a Manhattan street, facing each other and smiling. I couldn't believe it. I later asked how she knew it was me. She never saw me. She said it was my laugh. I wouldn't say my laugh is all that unusual, but I guess to a family member it's infectious. It hits your heart and resonates in your mind. I asked her what she was doing in New York. And she said she had come for an opera showing and was there only for a week. Neither of us has ever returned to New York, and both our visits were spontaneous trips planned just a week earlier. Since that time, my sister and I have never been separated. We both moved back to Wisconsin. We talk daily. Many years have passed, and we are now in the 50s. I truly believe God played a huge part in bringing us together. But our meeting by chance wasn't just a sign. I see it as more of a lesson. A reminder not to lose touch with loved ones. It is too easy to remain lost. After our sister's sister miracle, I don't plan to let it happen again. What are the odds? Jamie Brown is one lucky baby. She was born at 7:11 p.m. on July 11th. Her birth weight, 7 pounds, 11 ounces. We found a fix, 9 tricks to improve your life. 1. Build a better snowman. The key to making a great snowman, flatten snowballs. Jim Sisko, who helped build the world's tallest snowman in 2008, says that slightly flat snowballs make for a more stable snowman or snowwoman. Protect your dog's paws. Pets. If your dog hates snow booties, you can still protect his feet from rock salt and other winter hazards. Apply a wax-based balm to his feet before you go out. Then clean them when you finish your walk. Standard petroleum jelly will work, as well as balms from popular brands such as Musher's Secret and Burt's Bees. Rest your dough, 3. For a richer flavor when making cookies, chill your dough for a few hours before baking. That will help the moisture and fat spread evenly through the dough, that as it bakes, your cookies will have a nice soft center, too. 4. Keep shower doors spotless longer. Cleaning, water-repelling sprays such as Rain-X aren't just great for your car. Apply a coat to your shower doors as well to prevent buildup of mildew and other residue. 5. Treat a cough with oregano. Oregano is a powerhouse of a flu fighter, since it's antibacterial, antifungal, and antioxidant, says Patrick Fetterlone, M.D., who practices integrative medicine in New York. It can help with the cold symptoms, too, he says. Take an oregano capsule twice a day with meals, or take oregano tea by pouring 1 cup of boiling water over 2 spoons of dried oregano and steep for 2 to 4 minutes. If the taste is too bitter, add some raw honey. Drink it twice a day. Help your wipers last. If your windshield wipers don't seem to be doing their job, it's possible that they picked up some sort of particulate that keeps them from staying flat on the grass. You have to replace them eventually, but you can buy some time by scraping off the residue. To do that, run a nail file up and down each blade thoroughly. 7. Pick up glass fragments easily. Collecting the larger pieces of broken glass or a dish is usually easy enough, but picking up those tiny slivers and threads can be tricky. One way to do it is to press a slice of soft bread over the area. Just be careful not to cut yourself when you toss the bread in the garbage. Dim your computer monitor. Former Harvard Law School energy manager Eric Potkin found that reducing computer monitor's brightness by 30%, 100 to 70, for instance, can save up to 20% of the overall energy that the monitor uses. 9. Stay healthy in your hotel. When you think about it, it's not surprising that the TV remotes in a hotel room is often crawling with germs, as numerous health studies have found. But one of the dirtiest spots of all is pretty shocking. It's the bathroom counter. According to bacterial readings taken from 9 hotels by TravelMath.com, reduce your risk by disinfecting surfaces with alcohol wipes before settle again. Laughter, the best medicine. And as a picture of Frankenstein's monster doing Ancestry online, and his comment is, "Wow, I have a lot of relatives." One morning, Emma woke up from the start. Her husband, Jim, asked what the matter was. "I had a dream that you gave me a pearl necklace for Valentine's Day. What could it mean?" "You'll know tonight," Jim said slyly. That evening, Jim came home with a small package for his wife. Emma ripped open the wrapping paper, tore into the box, pulled out her gift, a book entitled The Meaning of Dreams. "I have all of Marie Kondo's books. Now I just need a way to organize them." "I describe my husband's style as that which you're wearing?" Every year, the Edinburgh Festival Fringe celebrates the world's funniest comics. That's what had us giggling to our kilts in our kilts this year. "I accidentally booked myself into an escapology course. I'm really struggling to get out of it." "A thesaurus is great. There's no other word for it." "A cowboy asked me if I could help him round up 18 cows. I said, yes, of course. That's 20 cows." Don't quite get that one. Oh, rounding it up. Okay. After learning 6 hours of basic semaphore, I was flagging. A widower and a widow attended their 70th class reunion, and a long-ago spark was rekindled. At the end of the night, he asks, "Will you marry me?" "Yes, yes, I will," she says enthusiastically. The next morning, the widower wakes up troubled. Did she say yes or no? Confused, he calls her and asks, "Did you say yes to marry or no to marry me?" "I said yes, and I'm glad you called, but I couldn't remember who asked me." Finally get around to calling all those kids that wrote up my middle school yearbook. We should hang out this summer. Things you'll never hear a three-year-old say. "It doesn't really look like a dragon, but never mind, I'll eat it anyway. Food is food." "Yep, that's exactly how you wanted it done. You've nailed it again." "I don't need it. Already have three. Let's just stick to our shopping list." "For Pete's sake, Dad, it's 3:30 in the morning. Please go back to bed. You're starting a new job, and this is the one night you really need a decent sleep." "Don't hide that square millimeter of zucchini behind the pasta. More green. I'm into the micro sprouts at the moment, too." "Doesn't matter how we did this yesterday. Things change." "Here's the remote. I don't really know how to use it anyway." "I bet I can get in my car seat before you can say the words. My back. I can't straighten up." "Here's your phone back." You're never too old to learn. Life well lived. At 63, Jerry Valenza was determined to get his college degree, and his master's, too. And there's a picture of Jerry. He wears glasses, he's balding, has gray hair, needs some work done on his teeth, and he's in front of an old Corona typewriter. The student arrived early, sat front and center, and stood out in my classroom in more ways than one. I say that he had about 40 years on his classmates in my undergraduate communications class at California State University, Los Angeles. He eagerly jumped into class discussions with his self-depreciating humor and wisdom of experience, and he was always respectful of the other students' perspectives. As each of them were a teacher, Jerry Valenza walked in with a smile, and he left with one, too. "These students gave me the confidence that I didn't need to feel bad about my age," Valencia says. One day, I spotted Valencia on campus. He said he would have to stop taking classes this semester and reapply next year. By then, he hoped to have earned enough money from construction jobs and have his student loan papers in order. But he said he was still coming to campus to attend events or see friends. He asked him earlier whether he could still sit on my consumer's communications class. "Sure," I said, but he wouldn't get any credit. "No problem," he said. Soon there he was again, back at his old desk, front and center, jumping into discussions on how to find and tell stories in Los Angeles. A 63-year-old Cal State L.A. junior with as much energy and curiosity as any of the youngsters in the class. For an assignment on changing neighborhoods, Valencia wrote about a favorite local chain restaurant that was unceremoniously closed. He called it an earth-shattering development and a theft of childhood. It is almost as if someone has stolen that childhood and replaced it with a slippery hill where everything they cherish will slide away, he wrote. A lot of Valencia's classmates apparently knew he couldn't afford that semester's tuition, but were still doing the homework. Here he is, willingly taking a class for the joy of it, and the benefit of learning, says Jessica Espinoza, a 25-year-old junior. You don't see that in our generation. Valencia showed up and took the final exam, too. Afterwards, students were kibitzing, and I overheard Valencia say he wanted to stay in school until he earned a master's degree. But it had taken 12 years to finish community college, so he had a long way to go. 12 years? He was in and out of school, he said, subject to his work schedule and whether he had money for classes. He had earned his Associate of Arts degree over the summer, then transferred to Cal State LA to start on his bachelor's. I needed to hear more. Valencia lives for the time being in a mobile home park. He greeted when I arrived and poured me a cup of coffee. He told me that his dad had worked in a brick manufacturing plant and an auto assembly. His mother worked at home. Most of his seven brothers and sisters didn't go to college, and none finished. Valencia is determined to be the first, despite his late start. He said he was an average student who struggled with math and went to community college a year after graduating from high school, but decided quickly it was not for him. He got into construction and then the insurance industry, but he always liked to write and do crossword puzzles, and I loved to read a lot, he said. He also loved watching Jeopardy with his mother, and he joked that if one of them ever won the lottery or became a Jeopardy contestant, he's used the winning for college. It was around 2007, Valencia said, that he got tired of telling himself he was going to go back. He told his mother it was finally for real. When I went back to school, she said, I hope you make it, Jerry. And I said to her, I'm going to make it, Mom. I'm going to make it. The plan was to capitalize on his construction experience and study civil engineering, but he discovered other interests. He was not the youngest student, said Grant Tomarsian, coach of the forensics debate team at Valencia Join, but he was the most motivated and the most dedicated. Tomarsian says Valencia was a great team player in forensics. He encouraged fellow students and inspired them with the desire to educate himself and live a more fulfilling life. Valencia's sister, Cindy Majors, says her brother was always bright, but he went through a couple of rough patches in his life. He's pretty much been homeless, said Majors, a retired electrician. She bought him a motorhome to help him out, and that's where he lived from 2009 to 2018. There is something splendidly traditional about Valencia's determination to get a four-year degree and then a master's. At his current pace, he'll be 90 when he finally hangs all that paper on the wall. But that doesn't seem especially relevant. He's found all the youthful energy and academic opportunities stimulating. Valencia's grade in my class this semester will not show up on his transcript, but I'll give him an A. In a more important way, it counts. Last week, we were talking about the idea of customer service and how to complain and things like that, and there was one section we didn't quite get to. And a comment is paying with our privacy when technology meets customer service. Companies are digging through your data to decide which agent you should talk to, and maybe even how long to put you on hold. Here's what you need to know. Customer lifetime value score. What is it? Is a measurement of a customer's potential financial value to a company based on data, some from surveys or third parties, including purchase and return history, demographics, and past even web browsing history. Why companies use it? To retain high-value customers, for instance, prioritizing their calls and offering them perks or white-glove service. Businesses have always known who their best customers are, says Sonal Gupta, a professor at Harvard Business School. But the richness of the databases available today lets a company know the value of every single customer. CR's take. These scores can rely on highly subjective data, says Kate McInnes, a CR Privacy Policy Counsel, who focused on technology. They also factor in information, including your zip code, which we use to be a proxy for income and race. People should not be getting inferior service because they learn less than others, or because any of the other factors used to determine this score. Likely behavioral pairing. What it is, a form of matchmaking that uses artificial intelligence to analyze a caller's billing history, demographic data, and previous interactions with customer service representatives to pair them with an agent they're most likely to get along with. Why companies use it? To increase profits and decrease cancellations. By and large, behavior pairing results in customers spending more, retaining customers longer, and being happier, says Chris Farmer, Chief Marketing Officer at Affinity, which provides technology to companies. CR's take. The algorithms that run AI are only as good as the data used to create them. McKenna says this is a new and fallible technology that could potentially result in negative outcomes for consumers. Chatbot technology. What it is? A type of AI that simulates human conversation. Most customer service chatbots respond to written communication such as social media messaging and customer service instant messaging built into a company's website. The technology is also being used more frequently for telephone interactions such as refilled prescriptions. Why companies use it? To increase efficiencies and improve speed of customer service. Chatbots enable companies to respond to basic questions almost instantly and receive simple issues quickly. They can also direct more complicated problems to the agents best able to resolve them. CR's take. You may not know when you're chatting with a box rather than a human as the technology improves. Although this could benefit both businesses and consumers, McKenna said, customers should always have the ability to speak with a human operator in order to resolve issues. And speech analytics. What it is, technology that listens to a customer service calls to identify trending topics, gauge the emotional state of customers, coach agents, and how to talk with them to identify knowledgeable gaps in customer service personnel. Why companies use it? To improve a consumer's customer service experience and identify common problems that could affect the bottom line. CR's take. Although advancement has been made in this technology, recent studies confirm that it's not foolproof. Companies that use PEACE analytics must ensure that the technology does not misinterpret customers' concerns or grammar in a way that can unfair treatment, McKenna says. From whole to processed. Different foods take turns being the dietary demon du jour, and currently processed and ultra-processed foods are the latest to come under the hot glare of scientific scrutiny. It's certainly warranted. Research has linked ultra-processed foods to a higher risk for obesity, heart disease, and cancer. Intriguing new work even suggests that they may actually encourage overeating, possibly because their particular mashup of ingredients disrupts the hormones that control hunger, or it scrambles the gut-brain signals that tell us how much to eat. Some processing is relatively benign and even enhances healthy properties. But generally speaking, the farther your food goes from its original whole version, the less good it is for you. We've illustrated the journey in a few common foods, from their least processed to their ultra-processed forms, to show you exactly where the nutritional designations occur. And there's a picture of a whole bunch of sliced tomatoes here. Tomatoes. Ideally, for the best taste, you want a tomato that's grown in your own backyard or nearby farm. Supermarket tomatoes are picked when they're still green, so they don't get overripe during the trip to the store. They might be refrigerated during transit to further delay ripening, which can also reduce their flavor. Some are treated with ethylene, a plant hormone naturally found in tomatoes, to encourage even ripening. So how is it done? 1. Canned tomatoes. Picked at the peak of ripeness, tomatoes destined for canning are washed, prepared, peeled by means of steam or chemicals, then packed whole, diced, crushed, pureed, etc., and put in a liquid using water or tomato juice. The cans are heated to kill any bacteria and then cooled. This process actually makes lycopene, an antioxidant in tomatoes, that's linked to a lower incidence of heart disease, prostate cancer, and other diseases. Easier to absorb, and additives may include salt, herbs, and spices, citric acid, and calcium chloride. Tomato pasta sauce. Like canned tomatoes, those used in jarred or canned sauce are harvested when ripe, then cooked down. Depending on the recipe, however, there may be a lot more of the tomatoes in the jar, and not all of it healthy. And not CR's recent test of jarred sauces, about half contained 400 milligrams of sodium or more per half-cup serving. Many had added sugars, too. Ketchup. Typical ketchup, made largely of tomato concentrate plus sugars, salt, vinegar, and various spices, can pack a lot of sugar and sodium into a tiny serving. Heinz Classic, for instance, lists tomato concentrate as its first ingredient, but its third and fourth are high fructose corn syrup and corn syrup, followed by salt and natural flavoring. 1 tablespoon has 4 grams of sugar and 100 grams of sodium. Wheat berries. These are whole wheat kernels straight off the stalk, with the husk removed. Boiling them with a considered a form of processing and is an easy way to make them edible. Whole wheat pasta. Both regular and whole wheat pasta are often made from durum wheat flour, which is higher in protein than some other types of flour, sometimes enriched with iron and B vitamins, but whole wheat pasta is less processed because it's made from whole wheat durum flour, which means it retains the fiber and all of the other nutrients of the whole grain. Number 2, 100% whole wheat bread. The whole grain in the bread is whole wheat in flour form, and it's excellent source of fiber. Sorry about that. Homemade bread may consist of a little more than flour, yeast, water, and a bit of salt, but packaged whole wheat breads may contain sugar, wheat gluten, preservatives such as calcium precipitate to prevent mold, and unspecified natural flavors. Wheat or honey wheat bread. Wheat bread is definitely not the same as whole wheat bread. It may contain some whole grain flour, but it's primarily white bread, made with mostly refined wheat flour. Its often lengthy ingredients list may also include sugar, dough conditioners such as sodium, a steroid lactate in slices, usually just 1 gram of whole wheat slice, has 2 to 3 grams. Chicken! And they have a picture of different ground types of chicken. Usually what you see is what you get when you buy a whole bird, or parts. But check out the ingredients list. Some brands are plumped up with broth, salt, and various flavors, up to 3% by weight or bone-in and 8% for boneless. Once you take the chicken home, the seasoning and cooking you do is considered to be a type of processing. Ground chicken. By law, it must be entirely made from the type of poultry specified. Per the USDA's preference, though not law, it should contain whole muscle material, drumsticks, thighs, etc., and other components, like skin and fat, should be present to natural proportions. Other animal parts, like giblets, should be secluded. If the label reads ground chicken meat, it can't contain any skin, and ground chicken breast must be solely breast meat. Chicken sausage. The meat and spice mixture that make up the sausage is often stuffed into a casing made from pork. Chicken sausage may have nitrates or nitrates added to prevent bacterial growth and give it color and flavor. These additives, even the natural-sounding celery powder, can convert into potentially carcinogenic nitrosomes, plus sodium levels tend to be very high. Chicken nuggets. The finger food usually consists of primarily of breast meat, with or without rib meat, sometimes augmented by dark meat or skin for flavor and texture, and sometimes marinated for flavor. The meat is chopped and formed into nuggets shapes, which are then seasoned, breaded, generally with refined flour, and fried, often with extra fat and sodium added along the way. Peanuts in the shell. After the peanut plants are pulled out of the ground, they are left to dry in the field for a few days. The peanuts are then removed from the vine and may further be dried on forced hot air. If salted, they have probably been soaked in a brine and dried again. Roasted peanuts. Dry roasted packaged ready-to-eat peanuts are shelled, roasted, blanched with hot air to remove the skins and split into halves. By the way, they actually have killed off the old Mr. Peanut. It's going to be killed off in an advertisement during Super Bowl. If they've oil roasted, they're blanched first, then roasted in an oil, coconut, cottonseed, or peanut. The ingredient list will say. Both dry and oil roasted peanuts may contain salt. Nutritionally, both types are similar to fresh peanuts in the shell, except for the added sodium. Peanut butter. Some of the stuff that comes in jars is minimally processed. It might be ground peanuts with a dash of salt, so you need to stir before use. But many brands on the shelf include hydrogenated oils, in part to keep the peanut butter from separating, and many also contain added sugars. Peanut butter protein bar. Peanut butter is little more than flavoring in many bars, such as Cliff Builder's Crunchy Peanut Butter Protein Bar. It contains 20 grams of protein, but much of that is from its first ingredient, soy protein salad isolate, which is protein powder that has been extracted from the soybean and concentrated. Next come an avalanche of sugars. You don't get actual peanuts until halfway through the list, which also has peanut flour and salt, soy lectin, and other additives. Rolled oats. Used for oatmeal, rolled oats are highly processed or lightly processed to make them edible. The oat groots, grain kernels, are steamed, flattened, and dried. They still contain all of these parts of the grain, the bran, germ, and endosperm, so they retain all of the fiber and other nutrients. Even less processed are steel-cut oats, which are simply goat groats sliced into small pieces. You could buy them with no added sugar, salt, or other ingredients. Instant oatmeal. To make oats instant, they're processed thinner and steamed longer than rolled oats. They're still a whole grain, but can be digested more quickly, which may potentially lead to spoils, to spikes in blood sugar. This processing is light, but more processed versions add sugar, flavorings, and other preservatives. Honey Nut Oats O Cereal. Whether the name is brand or generic, these healthy-sounding cereals are highly processed. Though the main ingredient is still whole wheat oat flour, it may contain three or four forms of sugar, such as sugar, honey, and brown sugar syrup. Other additives may include salt, oils, and vitamin E as preservative. Still more agarious, there may be no actual nuts, only natural almond flavor. Oatmeal raisin cookies. The typical packaged cookies are likely to be made primarily with white wheat flour rather than whole oats and may contain processed ingredients you probably wouldn't include if you were making them from scratch, such as hydrogenated oil, high fructose corn syrup, with protein concentrate and soy lectin. The shocking rise of Rx drugs. As prescription drug costs continue their meteoric rise, largely unchecked, people are being driven into the financial brink. Here's why prices keep going up, plus how to combat the sticker shock and still protect your health. Diabetes. Over the past 6 years, a month's supply of Lantus, an insulin drug, has gone up 24%. The price in 2014 was $408 for a month thing. In 2015, it was $441. 2016, $443. 2017, also $443. 2018, $472. 2019, $505. Michelle DeHetre is a 48-year-old mother of five, had to pull over while driving last March and be taken to the emergency room when her blood sugar dropped too low. One reason for that dangerous decline, the Lewis and Maine resident had cut back on her diabetes meds, unable to afford the $300 per month that made her treatment would cost, even with insurance. And Tamika Woodward, 42, a medical assistant from Aberdeen, North Carolina, moved in with her mother last February so that she could afford medications for high blood pressure, depression, anxiety, and diabetes. Even with insurance, just one of her drugs costs more than $900 per month. I have insurance, but my medications aren't covered. Their stories are not uncommon. High drug prices are financially toxic for American workers, says Stacy B. DeGizina, PhD, Associate Professor of Health Policy at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee, and co-author of a 2017 report on drug costs by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. A new Consumer Reports survey backs that up. 30% of Americans who currently take prescription medicine say their out-of-pocket cost for a drug they regularly take has increased in the past year. According to CR's September 2019 nationally representative survey of 1,015 U.S. adults, of these, 12% say their drug costs went up $100 or more, and those who saw spikes in their out-of-pocket cost were almost twice as likely to not fill a prescription, forego other medical treatments or tests, cut back on groceries, or get a second job. One contributing factor, no federal law or regulation effectively keeps drug prices in check. The heads of seven leading drug companies testified before the U.S. Senate last February, often justifying their high drug prices by pointing to the billions of dollars it takes to develop new medications. When pressed by senators, the industry executive said drug costs could be controlled only if the entire payment system was reformed. Indeed, to put all the blame, put all the blame on pharma is an oversimplification. How much a consumer pays for meds is also driven in part by drug supply, system middleman, whose wheeling and dealing with drug makers contributes to the rising drug costs, according to multiple government reports and industry experts. Shrinking insurance coverage is another part of the problem, with greater numbers of Americans paying a larger share or even the full price of their medications. For example, Brian Lumpkin, a 40-year-old from Valley, Alabama, recently took a second job as a paramedic, hoping to make enough money to pay for Epidiolex, a drug that Lumpkin says would cost him $2,300 per month and that his son needs to treat seizures, but is not covered by his insurance. Even if it had been covered, we still would have had to meet a $2,000 deductible, then pay $200 every month for refills, Lumpkin says. Then there's no sign of price increases slowing down, even as politicians from both sides of the aisle call for relief. At least 50 separate pieces of legislation to seek to control prescription drug prices were introduced in the Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives in 2019. Some would help to get generic drugs to market faster. Other would legalize buying drugs from Canada or allow the feds to negotiate with drug companies to get lower prices for Medicare. Not one of those has been signed into law. For CR's stance on these, see the Building Better World Together, and we'll look at that later. And while Medicare for All, or expanding the government's health care program to everyone, has become a common refrain in the current presidential campaign, it's unclear what effect it would have on drug prices. Meanwhile, consumers remain caught in the middle. Here we take a closer look at three complex hidden forces that contribute to ballooning drug costs and explain how you can pay less for your meds. Middlemen making money. Although public anger over high drug prices often focus on the drug makers, there's a middleman who plays a role, too. Pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, work under contract with health insurance companies to create a formulary, a list of drugs the plan agrees to cover, says Niji Sood, Ph.D. of the USC Leonard T. Schaefer Center for Health Policy. PBMs also manage prescription drug chains for insurance companies. Drug makers who want to get their drugs on a PBM formulary so that the injured insured people will use Choose Them offer the PBMs known as rebates. Sood says, as consumers feel prescription drug companies issue these rebates, some of that money stays in the PBM's pocket, while some goes to other players in the prescription drug supply chain, notably insurers, including Medicaid and Medicare plans. In other industries, that might be considered illegal kickback, but in the early 1990s, the Department of Health and Human Services, authorized by Congress, wrote an exception to these payments to federal and kickback laws. That allowed drug companies to use these payments as a negotiating tool, according to Stefan Sondelmeyer, former doctor of pharmacy, a professor of pharmaceconomics at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. PBMs have long had a lot of power over what consumers pay for drugs, and a consolidation of the industry over the past several years had made that even more true. Now just three companies, CVS Caremark, Express Scripts, and OptumRx. In total, they cover more than 150 million people. That allows PBMs to be more aggressive when negotiating with drug manufacturers, demanding higher rebates, so it says. These payments and other discounts doubled over 5 years, from an estimated $83 billion in 2013 to $166 billion in 2018, according to figures from Adam Fahn, an industry consultant and drug pricing expert at the Drug Channels Institute, a research firm. The Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, which represents PBMs, says its research shows that rebates are not responsible for drug price increases. In fact, they help keep premiums low for consumers. American Health Insurance Plans, which represents insurers, says that rebates are a necessary tool that allow insurers to negotiate with drug makers for lower consumer costs. But the problem for consumers is that the system pushes a drug full or list price like a car sticker price higher, as drug companies seek the financial wiggle room to provide a larger rebate to the PBM, according to a May 2018 report. So while the rebate system might keep some overall costs in check, it could be at the expense of individual patients who need expensive drugs. One dramatic example, Humira, a rheumatoid arthritis drug from the pharmaceutical company AbbVie. Since 2014, the amount of the company must pay to PBMs increased about 600%. That helped push Humira's list price up by 78%. AbbVie did not respond to requests for comment. How to address the drug cost problems caused by the rebate system? HHS has proposed eliminating the system entirely for the Medicare Part D and planning on commercial plans, an idea PBM have declined and HHS has reportedly dropped. Another possible fix, change the way PBMs are paid, to remove the incentives to make drug prices artificially high. That's a proposal from the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which represents drug companies. It suggests that PBMs get a flat fee for the work they do, instead of a negotiated rebate payment, according to Holly Campbell, a pharma spokesperson. This could make the system work better for patients, she says. Shrinking insurance. Until recently, consumers with insurance typically paid a flat copay of $10, $25, or $40 for a drug. So full price of a medication didn't matter much because most people never paid it, says Dustini at Vanderbilt. But that's changing as more expensive drugs enter the market and as drug prices have risen. Insurers have come up with a new way to require patients to pay a larger share of the cost for insurers to pay less. Coinsurance. Instead of a flat copay, consumers' cost for these drugs is often calculated as a percentage, typically 20 to 30% of the drug's full price. After a third to half of people and commercial plans are charged using coinsurance percentage for certain drugs. That compares with just 3% of people enrolled in these plans in 2004. Depending on the drug, a person could be on the hook for $100 or more per month. To illustrate, consider Humira again. The list price for a month's supply is now $5,174, compared with $2,914 in 2014. So people with a 30% coinsurance would pay $1,552 every month out of a pocket, $688 more than just a few years ago. To make matters worse, the coinsurance payment is typically based on the drug's full list price, not the discounted price that the PBM negotiates for insurers, says Stephen Buick, an industry consultant and a former executive of McKesson, a drug wholesaler. He thinks it would be fairer to consumers share the price based on the discounted price, and at least two pieces of legislation now in Congress would require insurers to do just that. In the case of Humira, that could lower the prescription coinsurance by more than $600 per month, or $7,000 per year. Another way to lower the cost of expensive drugs would be to share the rebate with patients as they fill prescriptions. Campbell said pharma says that could save commercially insured patients with a high deductible and coinsurance more than $800 annually. It would increase premiums by 1% or less. Steeper deductibles. High deductible plans, which have lower premiums but require consumers to pay more out of pocket before insurance kicks in, became popular in the early 2000s as employers tried to slow the growth of premiums, says Schottelmeyer at the University of Minnesota. Almost half of Americans under age 65 with private insurance are now in these plans, up 16% from 2008, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Insurers often cover a person's drug costs without them having to meet a deductible, but a growing number of plans, now 44%, require a person to first meet a deductible, either combined with their medical benefit or as a separate drug deductible, according to the Pharmacy Benefit Managing Institute, a research group. And until they do meet the deductible, consumers often must pay the full cost of the drug, not a flat copay or a coinsurance. HIP says higher deductibles are needed to cover the rising cost of drugs and the healthcare overall in the U.S. But those increased deductibles constrain budgets for more Americans, and employees with a family and a high deductible plan face an average of $4,250 before drug coverage starts, according to PBMI. That's almost 4 weeks of pay for an average worker. What's more, the deductible is rising, according to another report from Kaiser Family Foundation. It found that between 2010 and 2015, the average annual deductible for workers with health insurance increased 67%. About a quarter of employers have tried to soften the blow by limiting how much more people in high-deductible plans must pay for health care after they reach the deductible, according to PBMI. The average amount for these so-called out-of-pocket maximum is $5,380 for a family or $2,699 for an individual. Even if insured, consumers facing life-threatening conditions or co-disease don't have the out-of-pocket maximum, could be bankrupt by medical bills, says Dana Bettelson, senior policy counsel at CR. Out-of-pocket maximums protect consumers from debilitating medical bills as they can focus on their care. Should you order RxMeds from outside the U.S.? Americans spend more per capita for their medications than people in any other similar country, so it's not surprising that many people look to overseas to fill prescriptions. In a September 2019 National Representative CR survey, an estimated 3.7 million U.S. adults who currently take prescription drugs ordered meds from abroad in the previous 12 months. To be sure, the savings can be substantial. For example, Canadians pay 56% less for drugs on average, according to a 2019 analyst from the Kellogg School of Management or Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. But there are several problems. While the law is seldom enforced, ordering drugs from abroad or even hopping over the border to buy them to bring home is usually illegal. Exceptions include, for example, drugs for serious conditions that aren't available in the U.S. The Food and Drug Administration says it can't vouch for the safety or effectiveness of any drug purchased outside of a regulatory authority. Indeed, the vast majority of online pharmacies that can chain located in Canada actually operate from elsewhere and ship drugs from India, Turkey, or other countries where many counterfeit or adulterated drugs are available. According to a 2017 analysis by the National Association of Board of Pharmacy, an independent group that represents pharmacy boards in all U.S. states and Canadian provinces. In that analysis, 95 of the 100 online pharmacies it looked at operate outside of a U.S. state and federal laws, meaning they, for example, did not require valid prescriptions or were selling drugs not approved in the U.S. CR's secret shoppers recently found something similar when they tried to get antibiotics from a dozen online international pharmacies. Most of these pharmacies never asked for a prescription, and did not identify where the medication came from. Consumer Reports is allowing consumers to order drugs from Canada or other countries if safety can be assured, says George Slover, senior policy counselor at Consumer Reports. Alex Lawson, executive director of the National Social Security, Nonprofit Social Security Works, which tries to help people save on health care costs, says that his group has advised consumers on purchasing medication outside the U.S. Sarah Petticord, FDA spokesman, says an agency is concerned that the drugs purchased outside of the U.S. supply chain and continue to warn consumers against purchasing unapproved or potentially counterfeit drugs through illegal channels. Rather than continue on something that's going to go on for quite a while longer, let's just skip back over real quick to the Reader's Digest and read a couple of their true stories. Father Knows Best. My husband and I took our two boys fishing. My father was against it, claiming the boys were too young and hooks were dangerous. I told him he was being ridiculous and assured him that we would be careful. At the lake, our oldest son cast his line and hooked his little brother in the forehead, with the worm dangling across from his nose. "See, Mom," he cried as we carefully removed the hook. "You should always listen to your parents." I work in a small community hospital and often draw blood samples from inpatients. One evening, while I was preparing to take blood from an elderly patient, she stated, "I can feel it in my bones." "Perplexed," I replied, "but I haven't stuck you yet." She said no and motioned to the television. She was simply solving a puzzle on Wheel of Fortune. Teeth be with you. My father was a lifelong pastor. One sunny morning, as he was making his emphatic closing remarks, his false teeth flew out. In one swift move, he swept his hand across the top of the pulpit, snagged them out of the air, and put them back in his mouth. The sound of clapping, heavy laughter filled the room. Dad put his head down on the pulpit and laughed until tears came. When he recovered, he raised his head, said, "Dismissed." The congregation left still laughing. Dad said later, "It's nice to know that people were paying attention." Well, we haven't quite, but we're close to running out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thank you so much for listening.